Blog Talk Radio.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie. 'Cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, you give me all your loving and your dirty loving, all your hugs and kisses and your money too. Well, you know you love me, baby, until you tell me maybe that someday, well, I'll be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie. 'Cause that'll be the day when I die. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie. 'Cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, when Cupid shot his dart, he shot it at your heart. So if we ever part, then I'll leave you. You sit and hold me and you tell me boldly that someday, well, I'll be through. Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie. 'Cause that'll be the day when I die. Well, that'll be the day. Ooh, ooh, that'll be the day. Ooh, ooh, that'll be the day. Ooh, ooh, that'll be the day.
On February the 3rd, 1959, a plane crash occurred as three musicians and the 21-year-old pilot lost their lives. For many, this symbolized the loss of innocence of the early rock and roll generation. On this week, on the 56th anniversary of one of rock and roll's greatest tragedies, John and David Timmons will highlight the career of rock legend Buddy Holly, whose works influenced notably the Beatles, Bob Dylan, the Rolling Stones, among many others. They will also explore the culture of 1950s rock and roll tours, the events leading up to the accident, the aftermath, and its legacy. I want to welcome John and David to the show.
How you doing, John?
Great.
John's good.
How you guys doing?
Good to be here. Good to be here.
It's great to have you guys back. It seems like it's been too long.
Oh, yeah, it's been a long time.
It's good to be back, and it gave us time to reflect on a new topic, and the timing, being the anniversary, worked out perfectly.
Well, let's get started on this, because there's been quite a few shows out there this last week. I heard a good one on WCBE last week. John Peterson does a great show. He does Shaking It. I don't know if you ever listen to that, but if you get a chance to listen to his show on Saturday nights at 9 o'clock, he does a great job, and he did a good job on the Buddy Holly story. And I learned a lot from that, and I'm looking forward to learning a lot tonight. So what is it, John and David, that is so compelling about this musician that wasn't with us that long?
Buddy Holly, to me, was the first rock artist that actually, in the what I call the early times of rock and roll, actually formed a band, write his own music, while most of your 50 stars depended on Tin Pan Alley to write songs for him or some kind of company. Buddy Holly wrote his own material. His guitar playing rivaled Chuck Berry's guitar playing. He's one of the ones that made the Fender guitar famous, which he always loved his Fender. And when you can just catch the rhythms, how he was good. I think because he wrote his own material and formed his own band, I just think he became a living legend. I think my brother John, I'll let him say what he thinks.
I think John also, in addition to what we heard from Dave, I would say that he set the prototype for what really became the band of the 60s with, you had the guitarist, you had the drummer, you have the singer who also plays guitar. I mean, you can't help but think of the Beatles. You know, I mean, there was four members of the band at different times. You had the bass, you had the rhythm, you had the lead, and you had a drummer. And before that, it was usually it'd be a singer with a backup band, or they'd bring in musicians, so on. And in such a short amount of time, his music has so much influence. And I think as the years went by, I think he was even more appreciated when we see all the artists who tell how, when they were teenagers, when they were growing up, Buddy Holly was such a huge influence. Everybody from Keith Richards to Paul McCartney to John Lennon to Bob Dylan. And there's not too many artists that you'll have those greats all just saying how much they admired one's talent like they did Buddy Holly.
Look at the Hollies, John. The Hollies liked them so well, they took the name Hollies.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, what do you guys think that stood out? Now, I know, John, I agree with you that the structure of the rock and roll band with the two guitars, the bass and the drums, that was very prevalent. If you can, you guys can introduce the rest of the Crickets. A lot of people, I don't think the Crickets get as much notoriety as they should, because it wasn't just Buddy by himself. He had a great band with him, and you can hear in that song the lead licks there and the beat and everything just came together perfectly. If you guys could talk a little bit, if you could share with the audience who the Crickets were and what you think that the individual original Crickets brought to the band.
I will let John
Well, the,
answer
the,
first.
The group that I comes to mind was he had a person who was the I believe was the drummer, Carl Bunch. And the one I more associate with is what I call the second group of Crickets after Buddy has spent time in New York City and his original band wanted to spend more time back in Texas. And so they went back to Texas, and that's when he got along with, I'm pretty sure it was Carl Bunch, Tommy Alsup, and then
Tommy
the name
Alsup,
I was going to recognize, Waylon Jennings. And they were put together for that final tour, but the main band that he spent more time with, if you trace back its roots, he wasn't a Cricket, but probably the first person he would sort of collaborate with was a songwriter by the name of Bob Montgomery. Was more of a bluegrass sound.
Yeah, I guess back to 1955.
And then with Buddy's music, it would evolve and get slowly a little more rockabilly, a little more rock and roll. But that's the band that I have paid more attention to, even though I know there was an earlier Crickets, and they were, and I believe they even kept touring the earlier Crickets even after Buddy died, didn't they, Dave? Does that sound
right?
Yeah,
there was conflict with this early first pick of Crickets. What happened? Decca Records wanted to bring in studio musicians and bring in strings and stuff. Well, the original Crickets did not want to do this, and that caused conflict between them and Decca. And Buddy, at the same time, Buddy also makes a solo record without the Crickets, the original Crickets. And so even early in Buddy's career, and then they didn't like leaving Texas too well either, like John brought up. But the second group of Crickets, Buddy had formed them. They were all personal friends of him. And so what I always, to me, the big hits came with the second group of Crickets.
Now, when, like on the recording that we heard, I know that'll be the day was first recorded on Decca, and I think that there was some issues with it didn't do well, and if I'm not mistaken, Buddy's contract wasn't renewed. Is that correct?
Yes.
That is correct.
He gets in a big contract debate about it, and a local Texas label picks it up, and there was a conflict between that and Decca, because Decca wanted them to do certain things that Buddy wasn't happy with. And I'm correct on this, ain't I, John? I think it was
I can't remember the name of the second label. If I remember correctly, Decca pretty much when they pretty much dropped him, told him you can't record the songs in another label that you did here for at least five more years. I mean, they kind of left him with
right.
that final message, but somehow they didn't take the legal action on when they did release our opening song, which is That'll Be the Day, and went on to become a hit. I think by releasing on another label, he got around it, I think, by calling it, I can't remember if it was called Buddy Holly or was it called Buddy Holly and the Crickets, but I know
He just used his first name and left the Crickets off of it, so
okay.
Decca couldn't do anything.
Okay.
Because Decca held the right to they's trying to hold him to something on a contract.
Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting. I did hear a recording that, I don't know if you guys have heard it, but Buddy did record the telephone call that he had with the Decca executive management team when he was asking them if he could record his songs that he had laid down for Decca, and since they weren't going to renew his contract, was he able to record those again? And, of course, they said, no, you can't do that, like you said, John, and I think he went ahead and did it anyway, and I don't think they sued him or anything, but that kind of makes you think about some of the decisions that some of the record executives made back then that weren't that great.
Yeah. Hey, John, and another thing, a strong point on this, Buddy Holly was one of the few 50 stars that managed his own business, which was really different from what Elvis did and a lot of them. They all had managers do this work. Buddy put it on his shoulders, and I always thought, I don't think he realized the extra pressure it would be not only doing the business side of it and doing both sides of this. And so I think it put him in the middle of a lot of battles with the labels.
So do you guys know too much about that part of it? I mean, I know that he was grew as a musician. He loved to work in the studio. He loved the hands-on piece of it. David, you were talking about how that, you know, he was interested in the whole piece of it. You know, it just wasn't, I'm going to get on stage and play. He's involved in a lot of that stuff. Do you think that was very different back then? I mean, he was influenced by Elvis because he saw Elvis and he thought, okay, like you said, John, that he was with Bob Montgomery and they played country music, and it actually is really good stuff, and it's real bluegrass stuff, and it's just original to his Texas roots and to the music. And where's he from? Lubbock.
Yeah,
Lubbock, Texas. Yeah.
So that always makes me think about his roots. You know that, and then he sees Elvis, and then everything starts changing. Take it through that. What happens there? You got this country boy who plays music with his family, who learns how to play from his uncles, and he you know, a lot of that probably front porch music and things of that nature. And now he sees this guy. He sees this. Who is this guy? He's got his hair combed different. He's got a different kind of clothing on. He's singing differently. What's going on? Now everything seems to change. I see two big changes in Buddy's. Buddy went from country and then that rockabilly rock sound when he saw Elvis. Then when he moves to New York City, I think a lot of things changed there too. Because, like you were saying, I think, John, the Crickets weren't, or David, it wasn't, they weren't happy with New York City. They didn't want to be there.
No, they missed Texas. But you brought up a good point on Elvis. Elvis and Buddy Holly crossed paths, like you said, and he picked up a lot of things from Elvis. And Elvis and him actually played together backstage. And Elvis was what he's seen, Dan, that you can mix country with rock and roll. And when he got where Elvis was already the big time, and I believe the show they played together was what they called the Hayride. And it was down in New Orleans, and which originally was started by Hank Williams. And that's where they crossed paths, and basically he saw, man, this guy here wears the leather jacket. He does all this stuff, and And like you said, John, you put up a good point. I think that was a big influence in changing what Buddy would do later on his career.
Yeah, if I may comment on that too, John, in my opinion, I think for Buddy Holly, if I could think of a quality that maybe set him aside from his contemporaries and from Elvis, was that he was driven and he was also curious to see, and they didn't use this term phrase back then, but think outside the box. What else can we do? How can this be different? And it was really unusual because rock and roll was just starting. It was considered this rebellious music. It's going to hang around 3 or 4 years and
it'll go away,
you know, and keep the teenagers happy. They'll have their music. And then there's this fellow all of a sudden wanting to not only do the recording, but wants to get involved with the publishing and wants to make sure they're making TV appearances and they're talking to the media. And, you know, it was a big deal to be on these TV shows. Like, you had, it was the Ed Sullivan Show, and to have a rock and roll artist on there in the 50s, other than Elvis. I mean, this was very much middle-of-the-road America. And it was shown in that Buddy Holly story movie in 78, when it was Gary Busey that played the lead role. Now, from what I read, they showed that scene when he was at the Apollo Theater in New York and how quickly it was an all-black as far as the audience, and they warmed up to the music. They said that wasn't really the case. They made it sound like it was one or two songs. He was there for 7 days, and by the third or fourth day, he had won them over with his music. And to have this white band from Texas, and later the other artists he would meet, come to New York City and perform this music, he was thinking outside the box. That was just unheard of in 1957.
Yeah, he was very much the innovator and thinking about, you know, what was the next step. Now, I do think that you compare the. Why don't we take a second and compare Elvis with Buddy Holly? What are the things that you think are similar? And what are some of the things that that separated the two artists?
I think the things that separated them, I'll do this first. Elvis had a wonderful voice, but Elvis never wrote his own songs. He depended on songs. Buddy would sit with his guitar by himself, and he would write his own songs and work on them. Both of them were excellent guitar players. Elvis just never played his guitar much on live on stage because he did so many things, but he did because he had his band. And I believe another difference between the two of them, Buddy was a little bit more, John, would you agree with me? He was a little bit more set back on stage compared with Elvis. Elvis would have to go through his body movements and everything, and where Buddy didn't. But I think the big difference between the two, though, I keep saying this, he was his own manager, Buddy was. Elvis depended on Colonel Parker, and I think and between the two things. But that's where I see the difference. I'll see what John says.
I would agree. Colonel Parker has such a ironclad hold on what Elvis would do. I believe I'm correct on this. I don't think he ever toured Europe, which is unheard of. You would think, how could Elvis not make a concert tour of Europe? And I guess Colonel Parker had something to hold him back on that. And Buddy Holly did tour Europe in his short career. And Buddy, I think, wanted to be more hands-on and more control of his career. And I think Elvis put a lot of trust around all the people around him. And Buddy wanted to be more in charge. That's what I would see as a difference. But when it comes to the charisma, you got to give it to Elvis. I mean, to woo the ladies, woo the audience, as far as the ultimate kind of entertainer, you would give that to Elvis.
Hey, John, you brought up a good point, too. Elvis had the looks. Buddy was just like the average Joe on the street, and he had to wear thick glasses and stuff, and that's I think that was a good point on that.
Well, that's an interesting thing, too, because rock and roll and fashion, and we've talked about this, guys, several times on this show. It's funny how that worked out, that Buddy didn't want to wear his glasses, but he couldn't see without them. So he had these big horn-rimmed glasses on, and the kids loved it and thought it was the coolest thing. And it's a big thing now. I mean, you've got these, like Elvis Costello wore the big glasses, and now you see all these kids right now. It's a big thing to wear those big horn-rimmed glasses and to look have that style. But do you think that it was because his music was so above anything that the kids had heard, and they loved it, plus the beat and all that, and then they thought, well, this guy must be pretty cool. He's got these glasses on, and he wears a bow tie, and let's look like that. Isn't that funny how that worked?
Well, the key thing about Buddy, too, when he brought in Ritchie Valens, the tour with him, Ritchie Valens, there was another hometown boy had never left home, and he watched Buddy, what Buddy would do, and he was picking up stuff from Buddy Holly, but Buddy was one of them guys that Waylon Jennings said it best in his biography. Waylon Jennings was a good friend of Buddy's and in the band. Waylon said to get to know Buddy, though, you had to get into his inner circle, he called it. Because Buddy wasn't a guy could make up to people easy. He was a very hometown boy, basically.
Well, I like that part too. When I read a little bit about him, guys, it's like, you know, he was just a even in the phone conversation with the Decca executives, he was very polite. He was yes sir and no sir. It was like, you know, he knew what he wanted and he knew what he was doing, but he was, you know, he was just had that country twang to it, and he was just very polite with the guy, and, you know, not aggressive at all. And I just wonder how the whole New York scene was so appealing to him. I know that's where he met his wife I think she was a receptionist at a big record company or something like that, and he met her there, and they lived in the Village, Greenwich Village, and he just dug that whole scene, you know, that whole music and that avant-garde thing that was going on. Talk about that a little bit, because here you got this guy who's, you know, from Lubbock, Texas, who's, you know, playing country and western, and now he's starting to feel his oats a little bit and play some music that, you know, is groundbreaking music and the rockabilly sound. Now he gets into this culture that is a little bit different. What do you think that New York City had, what kind of impact it had on Buddy?
John, if I can take on this one, I can't help but in some ways compare Buddy Holly with John Lennon in New York City. John Lennon, when he came to New York City, it was like he found the home that he never had. And he, you know, ended up living in his last 10 years of his life, for the most part, in New York. He just loved the city, and it was the creative atmosphere, and with the Greenwich Village, as far as the avant-garde type atmosphere. And I think years before that, I think there, and maybe not to a high amount of as far as the similarity, but there are definitely some. I see some similarity between Buddy Holly in New York City and John Lennon in New York City. And I think it brought out a different side of each of them that they didn't know was in them.
Well, that's a great point, John, because I think that's it happens. It's like, you know, there is that creative thing going on there, and at that, especially at that time. Now, this was in the 50s, so there was a lot of the beat poets and a lot of that stuff, the beatniks, all that was happening. That was brand new.
Greenwich Village, yes. But I got to bring up this point, John. You're going to like this. I read one thing, though. He wrote his mother a letter saying, he said, in Texas, all the trains seem above ground. He'd never seen a subway, but he said in New York, they got trains that go under your streets. And it was new to him because here's a boy comes out of Texas. So that's why he wrote these modern in a letter.
Yeah, I think that's so awesome because I think it changed a lot of people. You could also look at the other crickets. Now, it didn't have that effect on them. You know, like you said, Dave, they wanted to go home. They'd had it. It was this big city. This is crazy.
Oh,
you know,
they
hated
this city. They hated it. They just cannot adapt.
And, you know, John, I mean, if there's somebody out there listening as an avid Buddy Holly and the Crickets fan, I would be sort of remiss if I didn't acknowledge the original Crickets. I mean, because even though I mentioned the later band, but they would tell you right away that when they think of the Crickets, they think of Sonny Curtis, they think of Jerry Allison, Glenn Hardin, that group. Because I think one of them, I think, was even like a childhood friend of Buddy Holly's. You know, that they had grown up together. I'm trying to remember if it was Sonny Curtis. I think
it was Curtis. Yes.
Okay.
And Curtis would end up joining Waylon Jennings' band later on.
Oh. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just strange, though, how the five of them, the four Crickets and Buddy, went there and they had completely different experiences and the way they accepted it, even though they came from a common background with their Texan background. And, you know, for Buddy, he embraced it, you know, and, again, going with my comparison to John Lennon, John Lennon, he embraced New York City. He came from this rugged town, which is Liverpool, and you know, right there along the coast, and granted, it's a city, but it certainly wasn't New York City. His roots.
But when you listen to Buddy Holly's music, he's heavily influenced later on by Greenwich Village. He is so involved in getting in there via Bob Dylan when Dylan first makes his appearances there. And Buddy, like I said there, he gets to meet a lot of different artists. He sees there's a different world out there besides Texas. But you tell that to Curtis and them, I think they miss them saloons and stuff of Texas too much.
Well, yeah, I think it's had a lot to do with the, you know, you're looking forward or you're looking back. And in this case, you know, you're talking about John Lennon, you know, and I love this part of the Beatles, that all of them were looking forward. They weren't ever satisfied with what they did. You get some bands that think, man, we're really good. Let's just keep playing this music all of our lives. And I think we have that jealousy a little bit, or whatever the word would be, to think of what Buddy Holly would have created after he left us in 1959. So what would have happened if he would have been involved in that scene of the 60s? You know, where would his music have gone? What do you guys think about that?
This, John, this is a good what-if question, and John knows I've talked this a long time. What would a Waylon Jennings and Buddy Holly writing team would have done throughout the 60s? It would have been amazing. You'd had two different careers. Would Waylon Jennings would have probably stayed with the Crickets, and then you'd have Buddy, and I think their songwriting team would have rivaled probably Lennon McCartney, probably Brian Wilson, because they had that writing ability. And I think you would have seen them go more to a sound like the Byrds, probably. They might have been a little ahead of the Byrds, but I think you would have seen that soft country rock sound of them. And I just figured they would have went throughout the 60s, and I think Buddy would have rivaled Elvis throughout the 60s. This is my what-if, and because Elvis goes to the movies, I would say Elvis would have not went to the movies because I think Buddy would have become such a big rival, especially from about 61 to 64 before the Beatles come. And John's heard me tell this story before, but I think basically Buddy would have rivaled Elvis through the early 60s because of the songwriting team of Waylon Jennings.
What do you think of that, John?
Well, he wrote his own songs. He was always trying to be creative. He was looking ahead. One really does wonder if he would have been an artist throughout the 60s. I think Buddy Holly would have been that bridge between the rebellious rock and roll of the 50s, when it was real rock and roll with Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, and the Beatles come in 64. I'm not sure if you keep a Buddy Holly active there with his sound, there may not have been this dearth in rock and roll of what there was for about 3 years. And I think, you know, they always say that if there's more talent out there, it forces others to raise their game too. If a Buddy Holly continues living on, who knows where Elvis would have gone with his music?
Hey, that's a good point. And here's a point I bring up too, John. Both Johns here. How about if Waylon Jennings decided he wanted to sing some of the leads on what Buddy was doing? Would that have caused conflict in the group? Where eventually we knew Waylon would become a country star eventually. Do you think that would have happened down the road, guys?
I don't know. I can't imagine Waylon Jennings being anything than a country guy.
But you wonder though, what if he that thing there? But I like the point John brought up too. We would have had that crossover before pre-British invasion, and maybe we'd had a solid rock and roll band, which we didn't have before Beatlemania. After Buddy got killed, and I think that's why the British invasion was so strong. It wasn't until the British bands come over here that a lot of these other bands started forming besides the Beach Boys. I basically, because most of them was either folk singers like the Kingsmen and them, but if Buddy Holly lives, I think we'd had rock and roll.
Yeah, it's definitely a big what if. Well, my guest tonight is John David Timmons, and you can check out their website at timmonsrock.com. We're talking tonight about the reflection on Buddy Holly and what happened, as they say, the day music died on February the 3rd, 1959. If you have a question for John or David, you can call in at 877-694-5613. I'll hear from you. Guys, just play another song. What would you like to hear right now from the list you gave me?
How about if we do Peggy Sue Got Married?
Okay, talk about that for a minute. And
I cried at that wedding, I remember.
And actually, we talked about this last week with the guests I had on, John Pozo, about their band, the 4019s. They don't play anything over two and a half minutes. Well, this song's 1.5 minutes. So
yes.
That's always interesting to me, too, because how long do you think these guys, when they were laying this down, do you think he wrote it for that, or do you think they wrote a longer song but they just condensed it and edited it up and thought, well, let's just get the hook in real quick, how do you think that whole thing is such a short that's a pretty short song?
Well, you know, the thing about the song too, John, is like it kind of is sort of the contrarian to what we've been giving credit to Buddy Holly for. As creative as he was, this was one case where, and I don't know if this was released after he passed away or not, so you'll have to help me out on that, but if it was...
Passed away when this was released.
Oh, had it? Okay. Yeah. Well, in that case, then, I was going to say, you found the hit formula, let's just change that one little line maybe in it, and we had Peggy Sue, now we got Peggy Sue Getting Married, let's make another hit out of it. So we'll give that to the... big suits up in the towers on that one, but it was a song that I guess the more I hear about that, it was like, hey, you know, we got this music Buddy Holly's recorded, let's keep on putting it out there. And I don't think anybody ever used this term, but now if a song like that came out, they'd use the term, it was a sequel. You know, I can remember when Harry Chapin did Taxi, and then some years later he did the sequel to the Taxi.
Remember Leslie Gore made It's Judy's Turn to Cry after It's My Party?
Yes, yes.
so it could fit in as far as a
trivia type of category there, you know. Incredible music, though, for what, it's like 1 minute and 31 seconds or something.
Sounds like the Ramones.
Yeah, let's don't waste any time. Let's not waste any recording time. Let's get it done. Well, let's play it. This is Peggy Sue got married. We'll talk right after this. And if you have a question for John and David, give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. And we'll be right back in a minute and 49 seconds. Track there because we they're short, so we gave you two for one on that one, and that's such an awesome song. That Every Day, I mean, it's just got it kind of tells you a little bit about rock and roll and where it was at that time, and it was produced very well. It just had, I mean, you're listening to Buddy's voice and you're thinking, man, it's as clear as a bell. And
that, John, yeah. I got to bring up one point about that song, Every Day. The little piano you heard there was a toy piano like little kids got in the 50s for Christmas, and they put three microphones to it when they was recording this.
Wow.
It was actually a toy piano. and which is amazing. But Buddy wanted to keep it that way, and the label wanted to use a bigger piano, but he wanted to stick with the format.
Now, who played Do you know who played that? David?
Buddy did himself.
Cool.
He did that himself, and that part. So it's always amazing when you say it's actually a toy piano. So that part always amazed me. And swear, if it sounds like something Paul McCartney would have done by himself on Big White.
Isn't that the truth? I mean, you almost want to follow up with from the White Album, "I Will." You know, I mean.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
I mean,
that's
it's just
good.
A similarity because, in fact, I think I Will might even be a little shorter than the song "Every Day." You know,
they're very close.
But you know, John, I think that song "Every Day" has actually became bigger than when it was released. Now, I could be wrong on that, but how many commercials have we heard this song even in the last 10 years? I know there was
Skippy Peanut Butter.
Target used it for a while. Target
yeah.
department stores, AT&T when they had the BlackBerry.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, it does sell. It gets your attention because commercials will make you think you're not paying any attention. Then you hear this great song, and then you go, "Oh, that's really a great song." But sometimes I forget what they're trying to sell me. So
that happens to me.
Yeah, it doesn't always connect that way. But let's talk about how that. Okay, so we got Buddy Holly, we got his music. He's recording his music. He's got a different label now, and we want to talk about how that the culture of the rock and roll tours and how that all with what happened that night in February in '59, how that changed everything, and maybe some of the events leading up to that, guys. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, the main venues back then was high schools because we really do not have yet the big places for to do concerts. And that when you was a 50s group, you especially the early 50s and the time period, so you played high schools, and what you counted was a big crowd, maybe 11 to 1,400 people. And it was a big difference in what we talk about concerts now. The travel was very primitive. You either traveled in your own car or you rented some kind of bus. You didn't have the luxuries like we talk about Led Zeppelin. They used to have their personal jet and stuff. You didn't have any of that. And I'll let John take it from there.
Yeah, as I said earlier, rock and roll was very young. It was considered the music for teenagers. So teenagers were the people that would go to see him play, so why not play the local armory, the local high school, and book shows, they had to have a way to make money, and so you do, 14 shows in maybe 15 days and had to travel by your own car, by bus, and I think in many respects they were probably driving their own way around some of the performers at that time, and you couldn't just do a single tour. You'd have to have several artists because I think the mindset was, who's going to come out just to see one artist play? You have to have at least two or three others, and that even goes back to when it was well-funded, like with Dick Clark and as far as the Cavalcade of Stars. I mean, it wasn't just one or two. He might have five or six acts that would travel around, and that was going with the big money of ABC and having his name behind it. So one thing I did read about this final tour, I don't think Buddy really was wanting the tour, but it was some problem with his producer holding up his money, and he wasn't getting royalties, and he was
he owed
just
Buddy
newly...
$75,000.
Oh, is that okay?
Wow.
Yeah.
He was a newlywed, been married several months, and was in New York City, and it's like, hey, there's bills to be paid. Let's get on the phones. Schedule some shows. Winter's coming up here, and they did this Midwestern Swing, this tour, And, you know, let me tell you, Iowa, Dakotas, Nebraska in January and February, I don't think groups, if they can have a decision where they want to tour and what time of year, that may not be a high priority.
And, no, that's that. Absolutely right, yeah.
Yeah.
And they get they buy a reconditioned Greyhound bus. It is in terrible shape. They're heading for this tour of, like John said, the West. The bus does, the heater is broke down after the first show. You not only do you have Buddy Holly on this bus, you got Dion and the Belmonts, you got the Big Bopper, Richie Ballins, a young Bobby V, but he's going by the name Bobby V Line. And here you go traveling this bus, very primitive, and you're hoping you have enough gas to get to the next place. I don't think rock stars now would only visualize what that would be, and not to have a heater, and then you're going to the South Dakotas at 10 below zero.
Yeah, I can't even imagine that. Now, at that point, in 1959. Now, he'd had how many hit records, and how popular was Buddy at that point?
Well, he'd already made two appearances on the Ed Sullivan Show.
And four times on American Bandstand.
And had several major hits already. And I guess if, you know, I don't know if they used the term at the time, but I guess you would say he was the headliner of that group that was touring around. He was the one they came to see, and the other artists were they were rising, but as far as the main event, it was Buddy Holly with his Crickets. And
Richie Ballins was just living off that La Bamba at the time.
And Donna, wasn't it?
And
no,
Donna.
Donna
yes.
was what was released after he after the accident. Am I right on that?
Yeah, Donna don't get released till after the crash. Yes, and on that.
Wow, okay. I didn't know Dion and the Belmonts were on that tour.
Yeah, they were on the tour, but we'll get into this. Dion on the plane itself. We might want to talk about this later, but Dion has a big point where he almost gets on the plane. It is very close to that night, and we might talk about that later, but there's something where he almost gets on the plane himself that one night and everything. But he was. Dion the Belmonts was on that tour, and the key thing about Richie Ballins, Richie was going to be – Buddy knew he was going to be a big star. Pre-Santana, he was mixing Latin music with rock and roll. And everybody thinks of La Bamba with the Pee Wee Herman movie. If any place you think of it, it's always in the Pee Wee, where Pee Wee gets up on the stage and puts the famous dancing shoes on.
Oh, yeah.
But La Bamba, and everybody, the younger generation connect with that. But Richie Ballins did not want to go on this tour. He was persuaded by the Big Bopper to go on the tour. Richie's only 17 years old. It's going to be a whole new thing for him. This would be only his second tour. And so you're a very young age, and they stick you out there in the Dakotas and playing these high schools. And I can just imagine how he felt about that, too.
Yeah, did they have footage of those, of any of that? Have you seen any of the tour?
I have the only thing it's real valuable now. If you ended up buying the program of that night of the plane crash, they put a program that had all the acts. The program, if you have the original, I got to be careful, there's a lot of fake ones out there. Now, there's pictures, but there was never no film of what happened. But the program itself, I think there's one in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I think there was one on the Pawn Shop show one time. And if you have an original program, it's well worth over $2,500, something you could have bought at the show for a dime.
Yeah.
But who would know what was going to happen that evening? Nobody knowed if in hindsight. But there's never been no film of that. There's a few black and white pictures, but there was That's the sad thing about Buddy Holly. The only few films we do have from him, and John, I think I'm right on this, is just from his Ed Sullivan appearances in his American Bandstand, ain't it, John?
Yeah, that's the only ones I've seen. I'm not saying that's the only ones that exist, but that's the only ones I've seen. And John, I was reading somewhere out there that if there is footage of Buddy Holly, sometimes it's not the best quality because when he did appear on live TV, the only way up until really the late 50s, they could save things, they would have to take a camera shooting of a monitor so that it could be saved, because otherwise there wasn't a way to keep live productions. And Buddy Holly would pass away just before they finally got to the technology to be able to do this. So that's why when you do see some films, it's not the greatest quality.
They're always snow. And the last TV appearance of Buddy Holly would be October 29th, 1958. He would do one more American Bandstand. He'd do That'll Be the Day. And when he picked up the idea here, and John Wayne keeps saying that from The Searchers, and that's where he got the idea for the song, and he would do that on American Bandstand. And Dick Clark says, we hope to have you back after the first of the year. And that's one of them little uncanny things, you know. And when Dick Clark comes down to talk to him, lo and behold, we would never see Buddy Holly on TV again after that. And so it's just amazing. That'd be his last TV appearance.
Well, talk about, I think it's a good time to talk about, you know, the tour and everything that leads up to that night. Talk about that a little bit, guys, because that's something that, I mean, we can look back at now and know it's rock and roll history, and then the impact that it's had since then. I mean, where people are even saying that, you know, the day music died and how a big impact it was on American music. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I want to, you know, point out something we opened the show with, that when this occurred, this plane crash on February 3rd, 1959, there was sort of a loss as far as the innocence of rock and roll. Rock and roll was about ready to grow up. It was about ready to become an adolescent. It was no longer just going to be this child. It became one of many tragedies which would occur in several years. I think of Eddie Cochran, who would be killed shortly after that, and it sort of became the story. Now you associate with rock and roll, history of rock and roll, so many tragedies for different reasons, and it took rock and roll into the news. If I can talk about Don McLean, he was. I think he was like 12 years old when it happened, and he was actually a newspaper boy, and he tells about in the song American Pie as he was carrying his papers, and talks about he had left a young wife, and many give as far as Don McLean give him credit for the adage the day the music died. It was not called that at the time. It has grown to become that because of the song American Pie.
Martha Hoople also did this. I got to get my plug in. They did a version of this at Hammersmith.
And, John, Dave said you would know that you probably have heard Martha Hoople doing American Pie.
I have not. I have.
Oh, really?
I'm going to check that out.
You got to check it out. They do a version
of it. To tell you the truth,
I
can't imagine it. It's hard. It's hard
well,
to imagine.
Well, Ian Hunter's version, but he wanted to. He did. He does a version. But John brought up some good points. We talk about that. But when you think about the time period, and this is what I always say. It's sad about a rock star. It gets killed in his youth, in a plane crash or whatever. You're no longer just a rock and roll star. You become an icon. I can think of Jim Morrison and all these. It comes past the level that where people talked about you in a different way. But when we think of Buddy Holly, the night of that crash, Buddy Holly is playing drums for the other acts because the cricket drummer has already got frostbite on his foot. And so you go for that sequence. What else would the lead star sit in and play drums for the other bands? You just wouldn't have it. I just can't picturize in today's times Bruce Springsteen sitting behind somebody's drum set for Tom Petty. You just wouldn't have that now because of egos, for one thing. And I, like John says, it was more of a innocent time, man, of the 50s and the transportation and stuff.
And well, we can talk about the plane.
Sure.
It was a very small plane. It was Buddy Holly's idea. Buddy wanted to get to the next city. They had just performed that night, February 2nd, and it was in Iowa. And next one was a stopover in Minnesota. And you could drive or you could fly. Well, the bus doesn't have heat. Buddy's tired of this. He wants to move on, get to the next show. And there's almost like, okay, who's going to get the other spots? There's two more spots along with the pilot on this plane. And it became almost a competition who was going to get it. And Dave found some interesting research, and we might have talked about this before, but do you want to talk to Dave about there was a coin toss, wasn't there?
There was a coin toss. It comes down to Richie Ballins doesn't want to fly. He wants on the bus. But Buddy Holly says, you already paid your $36. And Richie didn't want to fly. He didn't want on the plane. And Richie said, let somebody have my seat. I do not want it. And you'll see this in the Richie Ballins movie. And he tries to explain this. I do not want it. Well, the Big Bopper and Waylon Jennings, Richie Ballins comes out of the plane, and Buddy says, no, you get back on the plane. You got your seat. It comes down to a 50-cent piece. They toss it up the air, and
It was one of the crickets, right?
And they keep tossing the coin until Waylon ends up on the bus. Well, in the meantime, Dion does not have the $36 to get on the bus plane. This ain't that hard to be a rock star, so he said he'll stay on the bus. And he almost got on the plane, but he got in on the coin toss, and so the coin toss gets down to the three. Finally, down one of the crickets gets on the plane. That's between the Big Bopper and Waylon Jennings. And Waylon Jennings lose the coin toss. And while the Big Bopper's walking on the plane, this has become a rock and roll legend, Waylon Jennings says, I hope your plane crashes. And lo and behold, Waylon had to live with that most of his life. And Buddy says, I hope you freeze your butt off before the plane takes off in a friendly way. But that night, who could have been on that plane? It could easily have been Dion. It could easily have been Waylon Jennings. But it came down to the Big Bopper, a local DJ from Texas, basically.
Well,
and
let's.
If I can add one more thing, John.
Sure.
According to what I've read, the Big Bopper was having either a bad cold or flu, so he wanted to get on the plane. He didn't want to deal anymore with this cold bus.
Well,
so that
no
third
heat.
Spot was the one that was really up in the air. That one ended up being, it was Richie Valens between him and Tommy Alsup of the Crickets. And the coin flip, quote unquote, won, and it went to Richie. But years later, here's some irony for you. In the 70s, Tommy Alsup of the Crickets would start his own bar in Dallas, and he called it Tommy's Heads Up Saloon, as a reference to the coin toss with Valens he had done beforehand 20 years earlier.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
So Valens had called tails, and it came up tails. And here's the key point. Roger Peterson, he was the pilot of the plane, but he does not want to fly the plane. He wants Dwayne Mansfield to fly because Dwayne Mansfield has more air time. But Dwayne Mansfield says I do not want to do it. But Roger Peterson does not know how. You got to remember, this is a 50-style airplane. Instead of having what they have now, they had what they call a gyroscope for their navigation. On takeoff of the plane, he thought they were rising, and they were not, because he didn't know how to read the gyroscope, and they was going lower than what they should have been on the takeoff of the plane. Plus, it was a terrible snowstorm, and And the omen was when they started the plane engine, it took four times for the propeller to kick in. If that don't tell you something, it's kind of like a Halloween thing. Then finally it kicks in. But you always wonder if the original pilot would have flew the plane, he might have been able to rise. They needed to rise up. But the plane goes down within 15 minutes of takeoff, basically, the crash.
But if I read this correctly, they did not know about it till the next morning, I think.
Right. It was a local farmer comes upon the site of the plane crash, and you didn't have cell phones then, so he had to drive back and call the local sheriff department. And the plane was totally crashed in a cornfield, upside down. And the first thing he said, there's definitely no survivors. And the funny thing is, the people that their loved ones would have no idea about this until they hear it on their local radio stations because of communications. I think I'm right on this, right, John?
Exactly right. Because of this incident, how Buddy Holly's wife found out about his death, she found out by watching the news the next day.
Oh, wow.
And because of that incident, that's why now that until the close of kin have been informed, they don't use names, that's really what started. She was pregnant with their child, and the trauma of finding this out, she would have a miscarriage.
And Richie Ballen's mom was hanging clothes on the clothesline, and a neighbor lady came over to her and said, "Have you heard about your son?" Imagine the shock this lady has. She's hanging up her laundry. She runs over here in California and says, "And you said your son was killed in a plane crash." And it's just amazing. And like John said, that's what brings this up now. They do not tell these names now, but that was the first one. And I can just imagine how that went through his mother's thoughts there. Has no idea, figures her son's safe on this tour, and hear that news. Oh.
Hey, and then we take a step further. Back in Texas, when they heard that when it was first reported on the news, they said the members of the Crickets had died, and a lot of Waylon Jennings' friends knew he was a Cricket, and they thought he had been killed.
Wow.
And he had to personally call when he got word of that and told him, no, I'm very much alive. You know, I can't believe what's happened. He was feeling so much guilt. And that really lived with Waylon the rest of his life.
Yes.
I mean, he tried
he
to go
nightmares.
Back to work, but he was in terrible shape for a couple years thereafter.
Because that quasi kid about hoping the plane crashed, but you know, he was just cutting up. He had no idea it was going to happen
right.
That night.
Exactly.
And you just think about that. And it took, like John said, took him a couple of years to overcome it. And he never really overcome that. And it's just something he had to live with. But then, like I said, we just got to remember the times and stuff, communication. Now something can happen. The whole world knows it within 1 minute, basically. But just to think about how this all happened and as quick as it did.
Well, let's take a quick music break, guys, and we'll be right back. My guests are John and David Timmons. We'll be right back with the rest of the talk about Buddy Holly and what happened February 3rd, 1959. We'll be right back.
A long, long time ago, I can still remember how that music used to make me smile. And I knew if I had my chance that I could make those people dance, and maybe they'd be happy for a while. But February made me shiver with every paper I deliver. Bad news on the doorstep, I couldn't take one more step. I can't remember if I cried when I read about his widowed bride, but something touched me deep inside the day the music died. I drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die. Did you write the book of love? And do you have faith in God above? If the Bible tells you so, how do you believe in rock and roll? Can music save your mortal soul? And can you teach me how to dance real slow? Well, I know that you're in love with him, 'cause I saw you dance off your shoes. Man, I dig those rhythm and blues. I was a lonely teenage bronc and buck with a pink carnation and a pickup truck. But I knew I was out of luck until the day the music died. I started singing bye bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye and singing, this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die. Now for 10 years we've been on our own, and moss grows fat on a rolling stone. But that's not how it used to be. When the jester sang for the king and queen in a coat he borrowed from
back on the air, talk radio. Yeah, area code 513, you got a question for Jonathan?
Oh, hi, John. John, this is Chris, John and David's friend from Cincinnati.
Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hope you guys are all doing well. Yeah, good to talk to all you guys. It's a great show. I just turned it on about 10 minutes ago. And, boy, I found that very fascinating about the aftermath of the plane crash. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, in this day and age, you know, with the instantaneous technology we have, people, you know, would be finding out about it immediately. But back then, you know, this would have been national news, but it wasn't found out. In fact, the farmer you said didn't find until the next morning. And it's just amazing to think that the poor widows and survivors did not find out about it until after they heard about it on television. I mean, that's just something we don't think about today. But,
hey, Chris,
really makes you think.
You brought up a good point, Chris. Imagine that mother hanging those clothes, and they say her son was killed, Richie Valens was killed in a plane wreck. We can't imagine what that would be like, you know. And you like I said, it's just the primitive times of rock and roll back in, the travel and everything.
That's right. I mean, that was a different era back then. I guess that's back about when John and I were born.
that's right, Chris.
59, is that when it was? Or
it was 1959.
So you and I were about 1 or 2 years old, and it's just hard to believe there. But this is an excellent show. I always like listening to you guys, and John always does a great job hosting this show. And just wanted to call in and say hi and tell you I'm listening tonight and really
appreciate
the great job.
Well, thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
We appreciate you listening. And we have another caller, area code 419. Do you have something for John and David?
Yeah, this is Mike Burney, and I have a question here. I understand that after the plane crash that Buddy's glasses were in a snowbank and they weren't discovered for a long time. Are they now in the museum, or what did they do with those glasses?
A gentleman found those glasses and took them. They're now in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but the person, he originally sold them for $75,000.
Wow.
It was a farmer that had the farm, and he didn't find them until 1974.
Wow.
They had laid that long, and he plowed that long, and he found the original ones. But I believe now they're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I think I'm right on this. And the other thing that survived the crash was, I believe, one of Richie Valens' guitars. But I tell you, you just think about them glasses. I just wish I could have found them. I could have used $75,000.
All right. Well, thank you.
Well, thank you for listening.
We
appreciate it. Thanks for the call.
Bye.
Well, let's pick it up from there, guys. And it's like this, I kind of, what point you made, David, is incredible. And you said it also, John, where it went from, I think both of you guys mentioned it, went from being a rock and roll star, now you've got this tragedy, now he's an icon. Now his glasses were $75,000. Now the guitar, where does that all come from? I mean, is that just part of the American culture? Is that something that we're proud of in rock and roll history? Is that and that like gone to the point now where, you know, a rock and roller gets in trouble, they get in rehab, and we kind of make a big thing out of it? How do you think that changed the culture of rock and roll and that, and how extreme that is now with the accident and you know, that whole thing? Talk about that for a little bit.
Well, you know, John, we often talk about the Beatles and how many things they changed, and I think it's time to mention the Beatles here. They coming to America and always evolving took rock and roll from being teen music to becoming this accepted music of critics, classical artists were even trying to analyze their music. And that was unheard of in rock and roll music pretty much before the Beatles. And the legacy of Buddy Holly, I think, grew larger, this is my opinion, because John Lennon and Paul McCartney were such big fans of Buddy Holly, and they made it quite clear when they came to America, one of their biggest influences was Buddy Holly. And I think it maybe, even though Buddy Holly was already big, it made him bigger than life to have the Beatles saying, yeah, this is one of the people we admire most.
And then we got our culture now, too. Everything is collectible. back then, you just didn't think about that. It's just like I said, if somebody had bought one of those programs that night of that concert, 10 cents, and now there's very few of them, and you get think about it. And I think one thing about Buddy Holly, he'll always be iconic. And then I got to bring this up back about Ritchie Valens. Here's a young man, not even 18 yet, and he only made 4 45s, didn't even have enough time in his career to make an LP. They do, and you just think what his career would have been down the road if that and the crash. But yet he becomes iconic, the big bopper. And I think John's right. The Beatles, when the Beatles took hold and mentioned them, and then when Graham Nash and I believe and Tony Hicks were forming the Hollies, what name did they take? We're going to call ourselves the Hollies. So iconic as it is, I think Buddy will just live on, and you'll hear his music, I say, in the 22nd century. It's going to be ageless.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that. And I said there are musicians out there that their music will never die, because it's just they have a vein. And I think Buddy Holly was one of those guys that we listen to today, and it sounds as fresh and as real to me today as it did when I first heard it a long time ago.
Bobby Fuller, if you listen to "I Fought the Law" and "The Law Won," heavily Buddy and Holly influenced when he put that record out. Del Shannon, this is after the death. Del Shannon puts out a record. It's very Buddy Holly, and after he died. And then the key thing, though, the tour doesn't end. They end up hiring Jimmy Clanton, Bobby V. I believe they bring in a young Frankie Avalon. I'm right on this, ain't I, John?
Yes.
To finish the tour. And the tour continues.
My goodness. I didn't know that.
And they were all brought in. Dion and the Belmonts continue the tour. They got a tour. And so the tour continues no matter what. Jimmy Clanton would honor Buddy Holly and do some of his songs along with his, in which... And so that would be the ones that would finish the tour. Frankie Avalon is not getting well known yet. He just there with the tour, but it was mostly Jimmy Clanton and Dion and the Belmonts. But Bobby V was going by the name of Bobby V-Line, and he had a band, his own band, and he has not really made a record yet. And so but then that made Bobby V's career with Buddy Holly's death. But it made Jimmy Clanton a major star, I believe that right. And over in England, Adam Faith and Cliff Richard catch wind of his death. And Cliff Richard, being a big star as he was in England, Adam Faith, they both did a Buddy Holly song the following day after they heard the death at their concerts in England in 1959. So that's how big an icon Buddy had come after the crash.
Well, I know I was blown away when I found out that they continued the tour, and I think they only took like one day off.
Yeah,
one
day.
I mean, I just can't imagine having to pick up, okay, guys, get the instruments together, get out on stage there, you know. I mean, because now something like happened at today, they would cancel that tour immediately, the rest of it. I don't care how many artists were with them. And that's why Waylon Jennings didn't go to the funeral. He had to continue on with the tour to the next city.
He ended up playing in Jimmy Clanton's band. So it seems like, and the only one that made it to the funeral was Phil Ebbery. Phil Ebbery was one of the pallbearers because he was a very close friend of Buddy Holly's. A lot of people didn't know this. He got
they had
known
the same attorney.
Yeah.
They had the same attorney.
Yeah, the same attorney. Yes, and they got knowing each other. And so he ended up being one of the pallbearers. But I'm like John, though. It'd be just like your band. Here you have this major tragedy, and here comes management saying, well, we'll put some more guys together, back on the road, boys. I don't think I could have performed. It'd be tough.
What do you think that was all about? We can speculate that they had contracts and the show must go on and all that stuff. And they probably said, oh, Buddy would have liked it this way. But I'm with you guys. I'm totally shocked that they do you think they continued to tour in a crazy old bus with no heat in it?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I wonder. Here's the one I found out, John, that really surprised me. Not only did they continue the tour, some of the cities where they went to, the promoters wanted to pay them less because Buddy Holly was no longer in the act.
They won't give him 35% cut.
Yes. I mean, that's just incredible to me.
Because no Buddy Holly.
Here's these guys dealing with this trauma in their life. Someone they've known, they've lost them, and they're trying to do the right thing. Buddy would want us to do this, and you had this promoter come to the city and somewhere in the Midwest. Well, you know, you said it was going to be Buddy Holly and Richie Valens, the big bopper. They're not with you now. I never heard this Frankie Avalon guy. You know.
And Bobby V. Hey, John, this time we don't know who Bobby V, besides Jimmy Clanton and Dion, basically, you know, on the tour.
That's just amazing. It's kind of like the underbelly of the music industry there. It's like, you know, he was good, but let's just keep rolling. And if you don't, we're not going to pay you. It's that leverage thing. That's just amazing. I'd like to wonder if there's anyone around that's still involved, that's live, that was involved in that. I'd like to get them on the show.
It would really be good to hear their firsthand story.
Frankie Avalon would probably – now, he still survived. If there would be a chance, he'd probably be – and he's still around, I believe, ain't he, John?
And so is Jimmy Clanton. Jimmy Clanton.
And Dion
still,
is, isn't he?
Yeah, Dion's
right?
Actually –
it'd be fun to
touring.
Talk to one of them.
Dion's doing really good.
It'd be really interesting. But then again, like I said, it just amazes me that – they would have no that the management has no sympathy for death, that it comes down to the almighty dollar, which has not changed in rock and roll yet to this day. When it comes to labels, either you do something for me now or you see no money, and it's sad.
It's incredibly sad. So what we've got just a few minutes left here, and about 8 minutes. What guys did we not touch on that you'd like to talk about Buddy Holly?
Well, I want to acknowledge the song you just played a little while ago, Tommy Rowe. And
right.
If you didn't know it was Tommy Rowe performing That's My Little Sheila, you would think you're hearing a Buddy Holly song. It was such,
such a
tribute to him. And as Dave said earlier, the Bobby Fuller Band, When I Fought the Law. Over the decades, every now and then, there comes a song that echoes Buddy Holly. Marshall Crenshaw, Some Way, Someday.
Yeah.
That song, what, the early 80s? Oh, so much Buddy Holly influence.
Yeah,
The Clash. You think of The Clash. I got one, if it's on London Calling, and I believe it's the fifth song on that, and it's so Buddy Holly that, like I said, when you hear The Clash do this, no matter what we say, his music, it's just there. And it's so Buddy Holly-ish, and you hear all this stuff. And like I said, as long as there's commercials and stuff, the younger generation, like I said, Buddy Holly will live on.
Now, is there, I just thought of this, and I don't know. I mean, there's tribute bands for everybody in the world. I would imagine there's a Buddy Holly tribute out there.
Yes, there is. There's one out of Chicago. I saw it he was on WGN once on their news channel, and he looks very much like him. I can't remember the gentleman's name. And I got to admit, Gary Busey did a good job in the movie.
Yeah.
What do you think, John?
Yeah, I think he did. I thought he played it well. Some people were sort of critical that it wasn't exactly accurate, but I mean, for the most part, as far as the acting and so on, I thought it was well done. But here's something for you that I learned. Paul McCartney is such a big — there's two things I want to say about Paul McCartney and Buddy Holly. He's such a big fan of Buddy Holly. Number one, he bought all the publishing rights
right.
to Buddy Holly music.
Yep.
Number two, he was so disenchanted with the Buddy Holly story that starred Gary Busey in 1978, he went out to make his own movie and produced and got his own actors. And I've never seen it, but I think it came out like in 85 or so, where it was called, and it was a documentary called The Real Buddy Holly Story. And he talked to people that actually knew Buddy Holly. he had somebody produce it, and I'd like to see it sometime, but it was a documentary, whereas the Gary Busey was a biopic.
It never got released in the United States for some reason, John. I think it was over some kind of contract, and it got showed in England. But I don't think – hey, John, I think it's probably still out there somewhere.
That explains why I've never seen it.
yeah, I've never seen it. That would be great to see it.
Yeah. And, I mean, because I guess they went back, talked to all the crickets that were around, and people like the Everly Brothers that actually knew Buddy Holly and so on. But that tells you something about McCartney. He put up the money because he wanted the true story to be told. That's how much he thought of Buddy Holly.
Well, Waylon Jennings made the best comment about Buddy Holly. I remember I was watching Ralph Emery's country show, and he was on there one day, and he told me, but Ralph Emery asked me about Buddy Holly. He said, Buddy Holly was only a bandmate of mine, but he said, the day that plane crashed, he said, I lost one of my best friends. And for another artist to say that about another artist, and we know in the world of music, friendships can die quick. To this day, Waylon still had that feeling for him at that time. And you think of all the friendships that's been broke up by rock and roll, that tells you a lot.
Yeah, it's been a great time talking to you guys tonight. I just really appreciate it. And your depth of this subject is great, and thank you so much. We just got a couple minutes left. Is there anything you guys want to talk about, things coming up with the Timmons Brothers?
Well, I want to say that we are working on our summer calendar now, we want to put a shout out there that with our rock and roll trivia show, you mentioned about the tribute bands. That's a new category we've been incorporating into our shows, and it's really interesting to find some of the acts that you wouldn't think that have sort of a tribute band to them, and they usually have a name that hints at a hit song or something.
And we will be doing a show at the community center the last Saturday in June.
In June, we got that coming up, and in high school reunions, we enjoy doing those. We custom produce them to the 4 years of the high school for that group. It can really be a fun time of a lot of reminiscing.
Well, guys, thank you so much. It's been awesome. We'll do it again soon. John and David, thank you so much.
I always enjoy talking to you, John.
Same
thank
here.
Thank you, John, so much.
You can go on the timmonsrock.com and check out the Timmons Brothers and what's going on with them. And we appreciate it. And we got a lot of great shows coming up with John Talk Radio. And we just appreciate everybody supporting independent music and these shows. And we've had a lot of fun. So, John and David, thank you so much. And everybody have a great evening.
cold and old. Think it over,
over and over.
Think it over,
over and over.
There you go, baby. Here am I. Will you? Left me here so I could sit and cry. Well, golly gee, what have you done to me? Well, I guess it doesn't matter anymore. Do you remember, baby, last September, how you held me tight each and every night? Well, whoops-a-daisy, how you drove me crazy, but I guess it doesn't matter anymore. There's no use in me a-crying. I've done everything and now I'm sick of trying. I've thrown away my nights and wasted all my days over you. Well, you go your way and I'll go mine. Now and forever till the end of time, I'll find somebody new. Baby, we'll say we're true and you won't matter anymore. There's no use in me a-crying. I've done everything and now I'm sick of trying. I've thrown away my nights and wasted all my days over you. Well, you go your way and I'll go mine. Now and forever till the end of time, I'll find somebody new. Baby, we'll say we're through and you won't matter anymore.